Hello, Pals O' Mine. Yes, I have a new musical intro. Thank you, Eric Harrison. So here's something for you to ponder. A woman in a small town on California's North Coast humorously wondered what her neighbors would say if they could give her a Yelp review as a neighbor, and wrote the following post on her blog, It Happened at Purity. Purity is a grocery store. For 22 years, we've lived next door to the Mendocino Coast's only mortuary. We're often asked, doesn't it bother you? No, it does not. In addition to the mortuary business, there are two apartments on the property. The one directly above the main building is rented to a full-time tenant. The other, above the alley garage, is unoccupied. In recent years, the owners allow friends to occasionally stay in the vacant apartment. If they rented it for money, it could get listed on Yelp and subject to reviews, which might pose a problem. My husband Gary is in the habit of waking early. I know the term early is open to interpretation. To some people, 6 a.m. is early, to others, 8. I think we can all agree that 3 or 4 in the morning is damned early. By the time I get going, usually 5:30 or 6, Gary is in mid-morning mode and delighted to have company. I enter the kitchen to, good morning, how are ya? I groan, stumble to the coffee maker, pour a cup, and search out the nearest dark space. Our dog Lucy is a slow riser, but usually ready to go outside by 6:30. Today, she announces to the world that she does not like the vehicle parked in the normally empty space across the alley. Gary yells at her to stop barking while he carries a container to the alley and dumps cans and glass into the large recycle bin. I pour a second cup of coffee and sigh. Overall, the apartment above the mortuary garage is a great place to stay. It's within walking distance to downtown and a short drive to the beach. It's quiet on the east side, but not so much on the west. If it was subject to Yelp reviews, I imagine they would read like this. 1 star. This is a wonderful place, except for the cat that clawed at the front door in an apparent effort to seek asylum. We believe he's demonic. We will never stay here again. Lane R., Oakland, California. 1 star. We were awakened at daybreak by what we thought was a homeless meth addict flinging things while hollering in the alley. Trembling with fear, we peeked around the curtains to find the man next door dumping cans and glass into the recycle bin and yelling at someone named Lucy. We will never stay here again. KCH, San Francisco, California. 1 star. We found the apartment well-appointed and roomy, but as we moved our luggage from the car, an albino animal with a brown patch over one eye barked incessantly from the house across the alley. Efforts to ignore it only made the howling louder. As we approached the gate to get a better look, it let out a puddle of pee and rolled in it. Each time we went to or left our car, the creature yowled. We will never stay here again. Jen H., Kirkland, Washington. 1 star. When we arrived at 9 o'clock at night, all was quiet and peaceful. Little did we know this was because the inhabitants across the alley were asleep. At the crack of dawn, we were startled awake by the baying of a Louisiana leopard dog and a man yelling, "Leave little mister alone!" What kind of freaks are these people? We will never stay here again. H. Riley, San Francisco, California. So, what do you think your neighbors would Yelp review about you? So, what do you do when you hit an impasse in your life, or need to make a difficult choice, or maybe just need a little focused guidance? Do you read your horoscope? Meditate? A popular tool are tarot cards, mostly because they come with an instruction manual of sorts. Walk into any metaphysical store, and there are many to choose from, including Native American. When I came across the City Mystic Tarot, black and white photographic images of classic New York mystical architecture, my interest was piqued. It's different. Its creators, Ginny Jester, health educator, herbal medicine, among other modalities, and Christopher Hopkins of Good Choice Design, have produced a simple but profound blending of past and present with their self-published deck, which is currently in Kickstarter. So how did you two meet?
We actually met on the internet, funnily, but it wasn't for the purpose of dating. Chris was doing some work with an organization up here called Evolver, and he was running what they call local spores. So he was doing monthly community action meetings about making positive sort of...
They were all varying topics.
All centered around sustainability.
Yeah, there was like an off-the-grid sustainability one, but there were more out there ones too. There was like a 2012 one, and there was a psychedelics one, but then there
gifting
was like...
culture.
There was one all about water. They were all different alternative topics, and it was actually a worldwide thing. There were 50 cities around the world that were hosting these community meetups in their cities, and I was doing one in Sacramento, and on the website where there's like a lot of blogging and community member interaction, I had commented on one of her blogs, and we started talking at that point.
And I'd actually reached out to you because I was at the time living in Los Gatos, which is like south of San Jose and just over the hill from Santa Cruz. And I was considering starting one there, but the San Francisco organizer was super busy. She had like 3 jobs. So he was referred to me a couple of times, so it kept like this channel kept being built. And then when I started asking him about what it was like doing that, and then we sort of just started talking socially, it was like not very long before we were super head over heels in love.
Yeah.
And then like a month after we were officially dating, I ended up getting pregnant. So we were just have been in it.
Yeah.
Now our daughter's almost 4.
Gobsmacked.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. Yeah.
And what were each of you doing at the time that you met?
I was a body piercer at Bonehead Tattoos, and I had had this kind of like existential awakening about a year and a half before that. So I spent all my time laying on the couch at the tattoo shop, just reading and writing and learning about a ton of different stuff. You know, I was reading a lot of like Robert Anton Wilson, Philip K. Dick, Terrence McKenna, Carlos Castaneda. Daniel Pinchbeck was another one I was reading, who actually was how I found Evolver to begin with. He's one of the founders there. I was just going through it and studying all the time, every day, and piercing. But piercing is such a low-impact job. You're most of your time spent waiting around for people to come in to pierce. And then the piercing whole process could take 10 or 15 minutes. And maybe 5 people come over a span of 8 hours. So it's it's a lot of time.
A lot of time.
Now you have a lot of tats. What are some of the stories behind them? I would never have any because I can't even decide on a couch. But I appreciate the artistry and the stories behind them. So,
sure.
Well, most of my tattoos were just kind of... I mean, a lot of them are actually pretty nerdy. And I just got them because I have a Nintendo controller on my hand because I played a lot of games. And I have a bunch of comic book stuff because I liked those comic books. Probably the most meaningful tattoos are... It's probably the one on my head. This thing is called Barbalith, and it's from a comic book called The Invisibles. And in The Invisibles, these characters kind of like hack into this ultimate reality outside of space and time, doing it either through like meditation or ritual magic or tantra or psychedelics or whatever. And some of them, when they get there, meet this thing that thinks the entire universe into existence, and that's Barbalith. And so that's what that tattoo is on the side of my head. That's probably the most meaningful tattoo I have, but most of them were just, I was bored at work.
Young guy.
Well, that's a terrible reason.
Yeah.
I know.
You know what? I'm saying, I'm on the other end. I waited till I was 29 to get my first tattoo, and I toiled for years and changed my mind and changed it again and really had to fall in love with the mythology of something before I was able to get it, on my body. It's so funny being in this partnership that's, and in very many ways, it's such a juxtaposition like that, where, everything is so profound for me. And for him, it's like, yeah, it was cool. Not that things aren't profound for you, but, I mean, it's very much like, I bring the moody depth, and he brings the, but then there's the rest of this world, you know?
Bigger picture.
Right.
Well, yeah, you're really intense, and I'm not intense at all.
Right.
I'm just really, even-keeled.
Yeah. It's true.
So what was your first tattoo?
This one, actually, the Alphonse Mucha tattoo, for a few reasons. One, because I really fell in love with Paris. I mean, Paris, going to Paris for me was such a pivotal experience in my life because I grew up poor and in the Bay, and I mean, we were just like a struggling working class family. So the idea of getting to travel the world was, it just, it never really seemed like something that was going to be in my sphere of experience. So getting to go to Paris for the first time by myself and just kind of like face a lot of fears about traveling by myself in the world and being a woman out by myself in the world. It was literally the week after that Air France plane crashed in the ocean as well. And then before, the week before that, some young woman had disappeared in Paris. So it was very like nerve-wracking for me and my family. But it really was an incredible experience for me. And while I was there, just soaking in the architecture that Alphonse Mucha put into the city and the influence that he had on this amazingly gorgeous place, that really changed something for me or woke something up for me. So, I mean, getting a Mucha piece, regardless of the man and his life, was really attractive to me.
Now, how are you able to get the trip going?
Oh, it was such a great story.
Just for listeners who are trying to figure out how to embark on their adventures, maybe
right.
You can pass a few tips on.
Well, so, I mean, my tips are very impractical, I have to say, and it's kind of the way that I live my life is very intuitive based. What happened is this whole series of events, to sort of answer your question too, when Chris and I met, I was a massage therapist, health educator, an energy worker, and I'd been in my own business for a while. But before I took that leap, this was just before I really felt the urge to go to Paris, I had had this near-death experience where I'd had, my gallbladder was blocked with gallstones, and I'd had this really stressful job for a year managing a salon and day spa in San Francisco, and it was just a ridiculous amount of stress and anxiety all the time. And so I had started to get these pains, and then after about 6 months, it got so bad that I couldn't move, I couldn't eat, I couldn't drink. And so by the time I went to the hospital, it'd been like 7 days of no substances in my body whatsoever. And I had developed gangrene in my gallbladder that was spreading to almost to my liver. I mean, it was that close. So I had to go into emergency surgery, and I had this crazy amazing experiences with that. After coming out of that was when I really started to take my tarot work seriously. I really did a lot of work to heal from the more metaphysical side of that. So dealing with resentments, because that's a huge part of how those sorts of things start developing in the body. And so from there, it was just like a lot of steeping in archetypal work and steeping in meditative work and art healing kind of work. And so while I was going through this process, I had really decided that I definitely wanted to like take the leap somehow and travel internationally. But I was a single mom at the time. My older daughter is 8. So there was no key to that on the horizon. But one day, literally one day, out of nowhere, I got a check in the mail from the government that said I had overpaid in taxes 2 years before for, get this, the check was for $1,184. So I went online and I started just, okay, how much would it cost me to do seven days in Paris? It was $1,184. Exactly. I mean, I made arrangements with my parents to take care of my daughter for a week, and I just did it. And then everything else came together in terms of having the money to actually eat there and things like that. And it was just like, there were a lot of people who were saying to me things like, this is irresponsible, you should do other things with this money. And in a lot of ways, in a practical sense, that's true. But in terms of what it's done for me as a person and the way my life has changed and my worldview, I wouldn't change it.
And impacts how you're raising your children, too.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the goals for us in all of our projects is to do work that we can travel internationally with, and ultimately to get to a point where we can take our kids to Europe for summer vacation and just expose them to the world and give them the opportunity to see other cultures and to feel a sense of empowerment, like they really are global citizens and they can do what they came here to do in this life, whatever they decide that is, you know.
Now, you said you had a near-death experience, remember?
Yeah, definitely. With that whole hospital experience with the gallbladder, there was a series of really interesting things that happened. And the first and most impactful for me was the nurse that was actually my intake nurse. This woman was covered in, like, body art, and she had bright pink and bright blue and bright purple streaks in her hair, and she had diamonds and gems glued in her hair and nail. I mean, I've never seen a nurse that was able to show up to work looking like this, you know? She called me Kitten, and she told me she was from Vegas, and she just comes out here sometimes to volunteer or to work at the hospital for a few months of the year and then goes back to Vegas. Like, I've never heard a nurse's story like this, and she was just so cool and so sweet. She did a lot to really comfort me and calm me down because I was really afraid that I was going to die and what was I going to do with my daughter, and I was really freaking out. She was super, super sweet, and then when she finally handed me off to the next nurse who took me upstairs for surgery, I was asking this next nurse, so what's your story? And I was really kind of jacked up on all kinds of painkillers at this point, getting ready for surgery. But I'll never forget, she said to me, I try not to have a story and I try not to be from anywhere. I'm just here in this world being part of this world. And I mean, it's just like, who talks like that? Two in a row. So that was a lot. And then during surgery, I actually woke up early, and I remember the doctors and nurses kind of freaking out, and I wasn't even able to process what I was saying, but I just felt like I came through some kind of window or something. And the first thing that I said was, did I just have a litmus test? I didn't even know what a litmus test was. And I remember so clear Isabel saying that and the expressions on the doctors and nurses' faces. And then all of their faces looking at me like, you should not be awake right now. And you have way too many drugs to be awake. And then something put in the IV and then I was back to sleep. That really, really changed me. I had been a massage therapist for a long time before that, but just the way, it's really hard to describe the way that it felt to be in that and to be saying that and to be moved sort of through these layers of medication and deep sleep to come out and vocalize. And I mean, it's just, it was more than anything else, just a feeling that was really overwhelming that really opened me up to a lot of stuff that was, I mean, I'm a very practical-minded person, actually, and so the biggest blockage that I had in my life at that time that I can see now was the need to be uber-practical and the need to have a good high-paying job and a career that people would value in a very conventional sense. And
mainstream.
Very, yeah, and I wasn't a mainstream person, but I still had these goals and drives and desires to live in a mainstream way so that people would validate me based on see what I can do out in the world. And that really died with that experience. And then everybody was like, oh my god, Virginia's freaking out, she's becoming a tarot reader, what happened, she had this crazy high paying job, what is she doing, you know? And so the Paris trip kind of kicked that all off into, wow, Virginia's freaked out, but it's all worked out for the better. Thank goodness.
Sometimes you have to live a little Lewis Carroll.
Right. Right, exactly.
To see on a different levels.
Yeah.
Different perspectives and
right.
Visions, because some things aren't always seen with a visible eye. You could use an analogy of the different color spectrums, but true. It's almost like animals that supposedly can only see in black and white, and yet they're able to decipher and intuit
right.
shades and different hues
yeah.
of right. the grays and blacks. And so when you raise your awareness, it's kind of annoying that everybody likes to put everything under metaphysics.
Right.
If it's unexplainable, oh, it's metaphysics.
Right.
Because they have to have nomenclatures.
Right.
Yeah.
They have right. to tag and categorize, which is very sad for them.
Right.
Unless they have an experience, which hopefully is not a near death.
Right.
But just being exposed to a different perspective is,
yeah.
is really something.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and for me, before all that happened, when I was in that really stressful situation, and I mean, I was really going through this period where I was very much craving that openness. I just couldn't get there. I just couldn't. You know, and I had left my first husband and I, he's a really sweet guy and we're still really good friends, but he was very much living this, like, we had two Audis in the driveway and a nice big house and, you know, we played real estate games and all that. And to walk away from that was really difficult because I knew that that just wasn't my path. And so during that time, I was in this middle time where I couldn't get to the other side almost. I couldn't open up all the way, but I knew that I couldn't just have that one facet of my life, the materialism, sort of be my identity. And so I had, during that time, I was studying spiritual counseling and I was really working hard to open up my intuition more deeply because in the massage work was where it existed a lot. And I was getting these intense messages about people's trauma and how it was sitting in their bodies. And a lot of it was stuff that people wanted to talk about and work on. So getting that kind of feedback that what I was seeing was an actual experience, it was intense for me, and I wanted to be able to go to the next level and actually do something with that. It's not really appropriate in the conventional massage therapy world, and I didn't want to be there as a sort of a feel better pill for this week or next week, but to really like help move forward with trauma. And I think that the buildup of resentment and fear that then became this gallbladder issue was a huge part of letting go of all the stuff that was in the way of that side of my work. And then once it was gone, it just, so many things opened up for me, you know, inside. And then since then, it's just been like spreading out into the world.
A lot of massage therapists are now incorporating other type of modalities into their work. They realize that you can't just use one size for all. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
Same with tools for self-information, tarot being one of them, runes, tea leaves, whatever the case may be. So what is it about the tarot that pulled you?
That's a great question. You know, during the same time when I was kind of studying spiritual counseling and such, I had also taken a day off every week, and I would sit at Dolores Park in San Francisco, and I would study intensely archetype psychology, astrology, and where all these met with massage therapy and herbal medicine, which I was practicing at the time. And I was really, really interested in understanding archetypes, and that was very much inspired by going pretty deep into Caroline Mace's work. And I love her book, Sacred Contracts, also Entering the Castle. She's got some great work, but I could never really bite into the core of, okay, but what's the commonality with all these archetypes? You could just make characters up if there's no core. And she doesn't really present what that core is.
Some people do just make things up.
A lot of people do just make things up. And that was one of my concerns is in exploring the spiritual world. It's like, I felt like a lot of people were full of BS, you know? And that really bothered me because then I met people who weren't full of BS. And
well, you have really three categories. You have one that just making shit up and want to make money off people.
Right.
And the second category is those that have good intentions, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
Then you have the third, the elite,
right,
who actually do it naturally. They come into this world with natural abilities. Their senses are just naturally heightened, and they unfortunately sometimes get lost in the shuffle with all the lower level folk.
Right. And I would say, too, there's a subcategory in that of those elite who really, it's like if you look at astrology, if you have a trine in astrology, for instance, it's just like everything kind of comes together and flows. But if you don't put any effort in, there's a real opportunity to just lose that magic because it's too easy. And I think that's part of what I've seen in the world of people having sort of gifts and a natural inclination and sort of old soul kind of tendencies toward the work, the soul work. And so it's almost like with the square, it's like with the tension where you have to build and you've got to really work at it and you've got to do some defining and you've got to really pick some things apart and sift through what's your own projection and what's not. Even the people with the natural affinity can come in with messy wires crossed, you know? And so it's like the refinement, I think, is something I really value.
Yeah, but again, it's not a subcategory. It's the same basic three categories.
Yeah.
Astrology is a great example for me. I have met so many self-proclaimed master astrologers.
Right.
Not one has guessed my sign. Mm. Not one.
Wow.
You can lump so many people with a myriad of backgrounds and personalities and tendencies all in the same group, and it's crazy. Now, there may be a validity to doing a person's birth chart, like their actual one-on-one.
Right.
But then again, you're just really reading the sciences.
Right.
What I'm talking about is a natural ability to hear and feel what's the energy, the time continuum, the life force, which is separate and apart from anything else that's flowing around it like different planets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So tarot card reading and other tools, as I say, are a way for you to answer your own questions or you're not sure what kind of a decision to make, and you know intuitively that you know what the answer is.
Right.
You also know that your friends and family, as much as they'd like to help, don't have it either.
Right.
Now, when you have a tarot card layout that you're doing it for yourself, say, you still have to have an intuition.
Right.
You can memorize all the interpretations that are out there that continually change.
Sure.
But it still comes down to your natural listening ability.
Sure.
Consciously or otherwise.
Sure.
And that's why I say there really is a three categories. And for those of us that pay attention, you can feel someone who is a natural. right. as opposed to those who are a student, and because it's not what they are naturally inclined to do, but they haven't learned yet or discovered
right.
what their natural abilities are matched up with.
Right.
Now, what I really love about your card is that it brings a different perspective to the deck. Of course, there's all sorts of different tarot decks out right. of their different illustrations.
Gazillions.
And, oh.
yeah. yeah.
It's fun to pick them up and just kind of get a feel for it. But I love that you're using actual photographs, as you say, architecture, but you've started in New York.
Yes. And it all kind of wraps into what we were kind of just talking about with why tarot. For me, the thing that really got me about tarot was I was studying astrology and how all of these things overlay, all of these sort of woo-woo sciences, where I really wanted to know, where is the core of truth in this? Where is this useful to people like me, who are very practically minded and a little bit intense, you know? I mean, I have bipolar. I've been dealing with my own emotional intensity for a very long time. So I'm very keen on finding tools to work with that that aren't someone else kind of taking my power and then saying how I should be or who I should be with that. And so for me, the thing that really just bit my heart about tarot was that it's just a very well-defined set of archetypal terms. And what I mean by that is, in the deck, you have these two separate decks. You have the majors and the minors. And the majors are so beautifully indicative of the hero's journey, of the same monomyth that you find through all cultures. You can fit it with the Mayan monomythology. You can find it with the Joseph Campbell version of the hero's journey. You can find it in ancient Greek mythology. Everywhere you look, that same story theme is reinforced. And so it's the kind of tool that can really be reflective of many different cultures, different generations, different geographical locations, and also different mindsets and sort of self-perceptions. And then the minors really talk a lot about how that unfolds for us, what triggers us into those different growth phases and developmental phases. And so the reason that I wanted to start New York to come back around with that is, with this trip in Paris, I was really studying tarot pretty intensely, and I had this tarot workbook that I loved, but the images just did nothing for me. And I was just in this gorgeous place with just the sound of French all around me and lights and glass clinking. And it just, I mean, I felt like I was having a lifegasm the entire time I was there. It was amazing. And then I'd look down at this book and I'd have all this emotional energy to pour into the work. And those images did absolutely nothing for me. You know, I just had no desire to be working with them or looking at them. And then I would look around and have all these feelings and experiences about what I was seeing and what these people had built. And what, I mean, God, some of those buildings have been there for more than 1,000 years. Why is this not part of the tarot experience? And so from there, I really spent, after I came home, a lot of time learning about the French Revolution and the history of the sort of fall of the monarchies in Europe. And what was really interesting to me about that was the role that the occult actually played in all of that. A lot of the Jacobins were very well informed with the occult, and a huge part of the French Enlightenment had to do with this sort of occult information, be it astrology or Jewish Kabbalism or archetypal study or religious study. This had now started to kind of seep into the people, and by the people I actually mean like the nobility and not just the royal families. And so as that started to unlock, a lot of the things that were done to move the revolution forward had a lot to do with manipulating these archetypes and having a very clear understanding of that, and sort of having social sway by way of the media at the time to get people to be so emotionally vehement as to take down this royal family. So that was really striking to me. And then later in 2012, Chris and I took a 5-city trip to Europe, which was also amazing for us, and also happened by way of magic. The government owed me money. And I didn't know.
There's a theme here.
It's amazing. I literally called my bank account one morning to make sure I had $40 to pay my phone bill. And I had $40,000 the government had owed me from back pay for years and years. It was amazing. It was amazing. The next
amazing call, is an understatement.
The next call that I made was to the Department of Treasury to say, are you sure this is right? I really don't want to get in trouble. I don't know what this is about. And I said, no, I mean, unless you want to not have it. Yes, we've reviewed it. That was amazing. So we definitely took that opportunity to travel. And when we did, when we went to Europe, the first city we went to was London. And it was the same thing. It was just like, God, there's just all this history from the Knights Templars and all this history from the occult and the Masonic orders. I mean, it's colored everywhere and no one cares or notices or pays very much attention to it. So when I really decided that I was definitely going to make a photographic deck of a city, it was like, okay, I'm going to focus on the architecture and the spell casting that's going on there, or the messages that are being conveyed that just kind of go over everyone's head. And so when it came down to time to start, he actually had, his brother was living in New York earlier this year for just a little while. So we had the opportunity to go. We had saved up a bunch of money to do a Gypsy Bus tour because we were working on the festival circuit and I was out doing readings and selling my herbal medicine and things. And it just became clear that it was just too disorganized for us to take that money and put it into the festival circuit. It was just like, oh, we'd get an email 3 days before we were supposed to be at some festival in Arizona. That just wasn't going to work for us as parents.
Well, they were gypsies.
Right. They were gypsies. And we wanted to be gypsies too, but we also wanted to be responsible gypsies. And it turns out that wasn't the way to do it. So we were kind of bummed, and we had this money saved up for this gypsy bus that we were going to build. Well, and we said,
it wasn't saved up. It was my tax return.
Oh, right.
And we were planning on that.
We also had a little bit of money saved up that we actually set aside for this. And we'd made a bunch of changes in our lives. Like, we moved in with parents and did everything we could to whittle down our financial responsibilities so that we could pour our funds into the Gypsy Bus Tour. And so we decided, you know, we have this opportunity with New York. New York also has this, of all the cities in the United States, New York has the strongest tie to Europe and also the most palpable occult coloring, if you will, in terms of architecture.
And also, that was the major port for immigrants, so of course that would be.
Right, exactly. And so we definitely decided that we could have started in Paris, which is where I wanted to go first. We could have started in London, but it's like New York is our cultural mother, and we are Americans. And I just felt like it was a good way to tap into the magical gateway that is what we're trying to do with this deck, by starting with the language that we really speak. And it was a bit of a different experience for us, like, preparing for the trip and everything, because we weren't preparing for, like, different currencies, and we weren't preparing for different languages. And even just that in itself was kind of a strange difference for us in terms of traveling. And I felt like New York presented to us the opportunity to be American, to be a part of what was going on, to be a part of the spells that were being cast and what we were witnessing, like, to see ourselves as part of that crowd. Like, New York culture permeates everything in the U.S. They set the bar so much in terms of art, culture, music, what's forward, what's progressive, what's important. And so to get to go to New York to do our first deck just felt like the most appropriate thing. And when we got there, we found even more overt occult reference in the architecture than we were expecting, for sure.
So where did you start?
I mean, we started Manhattan.
Yeah, like by Times Square was where we first started. We got off at Penn Station the first day. You're taking photos and you're just taking photos.
Yeah, we were just
there.
I just kind of spent like that first day by myself with headphones, just walking down 45th, 47th, 48th and shooting just whatever I saw. And the magic didn't really start happening until the third day. I mean, I definitely got some great shots that ended up in the deck during that time. And even that first day we went over to the village, and that really, like, that did something to me. And a lot of those photos actually ended up in the deck. But it was when we got to Grand Central and just had the time, space, reality to spend a lot of time getting lost in Grand Central and shooting Grand Central that it really was like, oh, this infusion of, like, passion and excitement. And from there, it just didn't stop. It was just, like, hours and hours and hours on foot in the freezing cold. And it was incredible. There was just a few times that really my hair stood on end on that trip. And definitely the first time was in Grand Central when photographing and looking up and seeing this huge monument to astrology that's backward. And that's, you know, just that reversal, that's an occult theme. That's very essential in a lot of sort of secret society type relationships to archetypes, and especially tarot and astrology. So to look up and see this sky mass of the astrological sky above Grand Central in reverse, to me, read as overt spellcasting that no one would really know unless they took the time to understand the occult and how a lot of secret societies work and how a lot of their members choose to convey messages to one another.
Another thing I want to say, though, before we get too far away from what you're saying, another reason that it was really important for us to do New York is because neither one of us are big fans of this idea that you got to go to India or South America, right, or London or something to have this spiritual experience. And that,
right, absolutely.
And it's like, right, the reality is that most of those spiritual experiences that you have in the jungle are pretty far away from your actual, right, real life, and they don't have a lot to do with that, you know, because that's, right, not where you're at in day-to-day life.
Right. And we've seen more than enough people in our sort of circle of reality that have a really hard time incorporating their new sort of spiritual enlightenments into daily life in the city.
That was definitely another reason that we did New York first, even before Paris or London or, right, anything like that. And I mean, we probably would have done San Francisco, but your history would have made it a little pretty tough to get, right, a non-biased read.
I think
San
Francisco will be
one
of the last cities we do because, yeah, all my shit's there. You know,
we've talked about it, and there could be like a corner store that dead on means Six of Swords to you, but, right, nobody else is like, what? You know, right, like, what is that?
Right.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. Some of the photos that you took was, you probably thought, oh, this is obviously this card. Mm. But other ones, I'm guessing, yeah, you didn't know until you got back and were looking
through
most
of them. The way that we did it was very intuitive. I did not want to do research on the architecture before we went. I did not have a list of things that had to be shot before we went. It was just, and this comes from, that's actually why I don't want to do San Francisco, because I studied photography when I was in high school, and so a big part of that, those projects were like taking derives in San Francisco and taking walking photographic trips and things. And so that became a habit that I developed, just like getting lost with headphones in a city, taking sort of intuitive pictures. And I never really did anything with it other than enjoy the pictures afterward. But so with New York, it was like that same thing. It was like, I need to go to New York and wait for it to give me a read on its energy, whatever it is. And once I'm in that, we'll just see what it gives us. So we literally went, I shot about 3,000 photos and had no idea what I was going to use most of them for. I think the only one is like the magician. When I took that, I was like, oh, I bet that's going to be a great magician. And that's about it.
I also, yeah, that is, before we go there.
It's kind of funny that would be the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm the total opposite of her, and I plan everything out, right? So, like, before we went out there even, I was like, I made, like, a list of the cards. I was like, okay, maybe this, a monument could work for this. Maybe this building could work for this. I had this whole big, giant list. And I think the only things that even resemble anything on that list is the strength card actually does have a picture of the lions in front of the library. I mean, that's not what defines it at all, but that is in the card.
Right.
And then the subways and the chariot card. But other than those two things, I don't think anything else is even
close.
Because
of the obvious symbolism.
Yeah, they worked, right? Yeah. But, like, I think I had, like, the World Trade Center Memorial,
right,
as being the tower,
there,
you know, and yeah, I had, and then the Statue of Liberty was going to be the Justice card, but that ended up in Judgment instead, and it just, like, none of it's,
right,
yeah,
yeah.
I tried to plan part of it, and it didn't work.
Good, yeah, try.
The one thing we did actually have to pseudo plan, which was really kind of more difficult than we thought, was the suits. We had to plan what we were going to get to represent,
yeah,
swords,
and
represent,
we didn't,
cups,
though,
represent,
remember,
pentacles.
We went out there and we were like, I don't know, I've got maybe 2,000 images, but we haven't quite decided what we're going to use for our suits. And that,
yeah,
kind of started to come together organically, like, the last 2 days of the trip. It was like looking at things and going, oh, okay, well, wait, what's practical here? We have wrought iron gates all over the place.
Yeah.
Swords,
yeah,
you know.
It wasn't super planned, but we did have to make decisions about that before we were done.
Yeah.
It was like the last day we took a lot of pictures of stuff for, it was funny, we actually planned to use water for cups and then didn't use,
right,
water for cups. But
that we actually had this really lucky experience that was just totally like in the flow of synchronicity, because we went to like the second to last days when we shot the Brooklyn Bridge at the advice of some locals, some really nice locals that we met in the village. They were like, you've got to go down to the Dumbo in Brooklyn if you're going to go do the bridge and have lunch there. So we were expecting, you know, some San Francisco version of a waterside experience. And it was like these big brick industrial buildings with like super expensive shops in them. Like, it's just not what we were prepared for. But we ended up wandering into this really gorgeous little spot for lunch, and it was like a great refuge from the it was the coldest day.
That was the coldest
day. It was so cold, and we had like really amazing hot soup, and there was just all this green life. Like, they had this whole wall palette garden, floor to ceiling. It was beautiful. And then everywhere in the restaurant, I mean, any place that sort of light was being caught were stacks of glasses. So I must have shot like 100 pictures of glasses there. And then other places that we went out through the night, I ended up the rest of the trip before that shooting cups and glasses, not really exactly knowing what we were going to use it for. And it just ended up being so perfect as our cups suit. So well, we had lots of lucky experiences like that.
Yeah, that totally gave me the idea for the cups, those pictures. And it played with all the photos you had of reflections all throughout the deck and the city.
Right.
The first car we made was the Seven of Cups on the plane back. I was like, this is what I'm thinking cups are going to look like. And I used one of her photos of those glasses and made the Seven of Cups.
Yeah.
And it still is pretty much exactly how it was when I made it on the plane on the way back.
I love that they're black and white, that they're not color.
Thank you. Yeah. My dad actually is the only person who hates that they're not color.
Your dad's just trying to complain.
He would probably colorize old classic movies too.
I know. Exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, when I was studying photography, when I really fell in love with photography, it was black and white in a dark room with a developer and an enlarger. And, you know, it was like very hands-on. And I really fell in love with black and white and the light and the shadow. And you can sort of add so much in your own experience when you're just given that.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, because in books, directors or screenwriters, and they try to convert books to the screen, aren't always successful because often the characters have thoughts and you can't transfer thoughts. Or even descriptions you can, but to a certain point.
Right.
So everybody has a different idea of how the book looks.
Right.
And so to have something in black and white allows them that same experience, but on a visual level.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, you're the first person that really kind of caught the depth of that. And that's really it, because a huge part of my personal tarot study is with a group called Builders of the Adytum. And it's based on Paul Foster Case's work. And color is a huge part of the lessons in that. And I thought, I don't want to give people my entire version of tarot. I know the work well enough, I know the structure well enough, I have a really close relationship to these archetypes to sort of capture their essence, I believe. But I also want it to be someone else's experiential event as well. So getting this deck in front of someone else and having them read with it and not giving them color cues, but just letting them sort of go with it, I think is really key. And I think it speaks a lot to like the new sort of modern contemporary tarot that's coming out now. Like, I think there was this whole time in tarot where it was very much about the masters. And like Aleister Crowley and Arthur Edward Waite and all, and that's great. I mean, they gave us a lot, but also at some point it has to be the people's. And we're in this time where no one's the expert anymore, and the expert sucks. The expert is usually a sham when it comes down to it. And so giving people the opportunity to have a personal relationship that's based on their own interpretation, I really wanted to make decks that have room for that in there as well.
Well, again, as I say earlier, people who have natural abilities.
Right.
That's why a black and white is best for them.
Right, exactly.
Because there's a preconceived idea when you pre-assign colors.
Right.
So you've been using the deck for readings?
Exclusively. Since it's been done, exclusively.
And how's it felt for you?
Amazing. I have to say, it's a very moody deck, like me. I can't even... There's no bypassing that. But that's one of my favorite things about reading with the deck. For instance, when we finished the Major Arcana, before we even finished the deck, we did still finish off some of our festival tour that we had planned. So I read with the Majors at two festivals for people from all walks of life. And it was really incredible to work with people and get these very deep soul reads. Like, it was not light reading. And that doesn't mean it was heavy or negative or bad either, but it was like, I was sitting out in the sun for 2 days, 8 hour days on a little table in the dirt. And we were talking about what happened with mom at 12. And we had soul tears and we had, okay, this is done. I can put this to rest now kind of material coming up. It was really special to me as a reader to get to access that. And I don't think it's entirely attributed to the deck for sure. I think people bring a lot to the table to get that work done.
Well, again, it's a tool.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But I do think that the images were the kind that allowed people to take tarot a little more seriously, you know, and to go a little deeper and to have a little bit more of a personally relevant experience with it, as opposed to looking at some fairies and dragons and, you know, some people in Renaissance attire. Like, that's cool. But also for me, my work really always does come back to, let's deal with the trauma. Let's deal with the place where you're broken so you can get your power back. Let's bring power back to you. Let's bring love back. Let's make this whole again. And so in that way, I work with tarot very differently from most readers that I know. And it's one of the reasons that I don't just do any and every reading that comes across my desk. But in those instances, working with people with this deck, that has very much been the experience where, you know, we're just really getting to some deep soul material that people can really work with.
So this is not great-great-grandparents tarot deck.
Right, definitely.
So you're starting from scratch. You're not going through a publisher. You're doing it yourself, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Which is why you're in the ye old Kickstarter.
Right.
Because yes. You need the funds for printing.
Right, correct? Exactly. We are only, even with the funds that we're raising right now, we're still going to have to come out of pocket to print the first 1,000 copies. But it was, we just really needed, like, at least that boost. We're raising $5,500, and I think $500 of that is going all just to, like, Amazon and Kickstarter for
pretty
their
much,
fees.
Yeah.
So we're still going to need, like, another $1,500 to print the first 1,000 decks, which we can come up with. But there's a big difference between coming up with $1,500 and $6,500. Yeah, we're raising funds to do it our way. We've been really, really blessed to have a lot of support from the traditional tarot community as well. That's something that I didn't expect, but I'm also working with Tarot Professionals, which is an organization I'm a member of that's really kind of all about ethical reading and, like, what does it mean to be actually a really good ethical reader and where is tarot going? And so it's a very kind of grounded esoteric community, if you will. And they have done a tremendous amount to help us get the word out. They've backed us. They've been really amazing. And we're actually organizing TarotCon 2015 here in Sacramento with them. It's February, so we're going to get the opportunity to speak about the deck and modern urban magic. Like, what does that look like? We're also going to go to New York and speak at the TarotCon next October in 2015 with them. So, I mean, really kind of amazingly, doing it on our own has been the best thing, because we don't have a publisher saying to us, well, this just isn't the traditional tarot market. And we also have people who are really eager to see tarot evolve that are very interested in supporting us, which is, I mean, we couldn't have asked for more.
One thing that's always been important to me my whole life too is doing stuff yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've always talked to her about how I want to show our kids that you could do things yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that you don't need a publisher, you don't need higher education, you know, necessarily. Like, you could do stuff on your own if you just
work
put enough
really
work
hard
into it, you know.
Yeah.
Set an example by doing it.
Right, exactly. And it comes back to that sort of goal of, I never want my daughters to grow up feeling like they can't do something because they're poor or they're women or whatever. You know, I want them to grow up feeling like it doesn't matter what my circumstances are. If I came here to do something, I can do something. And I know for me, in my personal journey, and especially in coping with bipolar, a huge part of when things have gone wrong for me in my inner world has been around coming up with these outer versions of limitations of, you can't do this because you weren't born in this way, or it's bullshit. If I give nothing else to my daughters, I want to give them some role model for just, you know what, screw what everybody else says, you gotta do what you feel like you came here to do. That's kind of like the thing that keeps me going in this project and really keeps me passionate. If you stripped away everything else, the tarot work, the passion for trauma work, the passion for helping people and empowering people, it's always going to come back to my daughters and giving them some kind of role model to do what they feel like they came here to do in their lives, whatever that is.
You can check out a video of their tarot deck design at jennyjester.com. That's GINNIEJESTER.com. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. Dedicated in 1763, it is the United States' oldest synagogue and was designated a National Historic Site in 1946. During the Revolutionary War up to 1880, although used intermittently for worship, it was also used as a courthouse, state house, and town hall. Since 1880, however, it has been continuously used as a synagogue. The descendants of Jewish families who had fled the Spanish Inquisition in Portugal, arriving in Rhode Island seeking greater religious tolerance, founded its congregation in 1658. President George Washington wrote a letter in 1790 to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, pledging that this new nation would give to bigotry no sanction and to persecution no assistance. The synagogue symbolically stands for religious freedom for all Americans. As you know, I cherish creativity, including recycled home and art pieces. There's a local store called Art of Toys, which sells not only vintage toys, but art pieces that meld toys as art and art as toys, with each month offering a theme such as fairies, Alice to Oz, puppets, monsters, and cars. I wish I had just a pinch of the imaginative processes behind these pieces. By the way, the store sells framed photographic images from the City Mystic Tarot deck. Artoftoys.com. Do something different. Next time you pop some popcorn, add food coloring to the melted butter you pour over it.